I believe this thing is on. I'm going to proceed as if it is. Good morning. Or whatever time it is, you know, wherever you happen to be. August 3rd, coming at you live. It is 10:31 a.m. where I'm at here in a beautiful Belgrade, Serbia. Huge losses. Before we jump in, man, this is catastrophic. somewhere between 1,000 and 1,300 were killed 2 days ago over a 24-hour period of Ukrainian forces. And then in the day before, some other crazy number. I haven't even looked at it yet, but Zelensky did a talk about it. For everybody, we have a little like text translation, not like subtitles, but just because, you know, it's whatever 14 seconds that he talks. So there's the subtitle is right there. And he's basically saying that, in his own words, it's hell. It can't be described in words. I mean, he's trying to do that political thing of saying what the soldiers in the field are thinking, that it's just hell and can't be described. They're not talking about a hell lot of dust clots, you know, or something like that. They're not talking about hellishly unsanitary conditions. They're talking about the hell of people's eyeballs and shit fucking splattered everywhere. That, you know, that's the hell they're talking about, just incidentally. I mean, in case there was any thought that it was some other kind of hell. They mean, you know, heads vaporizing and stuff. Everyone there on the front is just, you know, wondering if they're next. Am I next? But this will, you know, as we've said, you know, there was like a thing with Bucha. I had said, you know, they, I said some of these are look like these, actually look like the mannequins that are used in like kind of in the background, or you've seen maybe there's sometimes like they're like trauma practice dummies or something. Others were frozen bodies. I said, these are frozen bodies. They have trucks. They bring them in. We know that because we're talking about Bucha, but we know that because of the same stunts that were done in Syria. So I didn't have like a, you know, fever dream or something and have some, you know, fucking angel didn't visit me from on high and inform me that they were going to bring frozen bodies in on trucks on, you know, from the freezer of the morgues. I knew that, first of all, Arestovich had been planning, been part of the psychological operations planning, and is a big fan of ISIS and Al Qaeda. So when in the White Helmets was like a way to sort of politically launder ISIS into the good guys, I don't know if people knew that these were the same guys. Like literally not, I'm not saying, oh, they share a sentence in their ideas or something. I mean, literally, you know, the same blokes in one organization are the, you know, leaders of the other. So, and also the regular membership too, they would literally be in these white helmets and these little kind of like cleanup outfits. And then the next day they'd be, you know, back doing their thing, cutting heads off. Oftentimes they were able to first respond, because first they would shell the place and then they would like run in and then, you know, save the people that they liked. It's all justified, you know, if you believe in their beliefs, you know, it all makes sense. And that's the crazy thing with the human condition. The things that we justify make sense to us. The killing. There's always justified killing. So we always have to ask, how are we sweeping too many things under that category? You know, giving the state the power to do that, that's a tough one. Because the state, a lot of people think it's a good idea until the state comes after them. What if the state is not legitimate? Or what if giving it these powers is what makes it not legitimate? It's really strange. Very interesting questions. I don't have answers today on that. But we are here. We are going to talk about, there is an open comments thread. We are going to talk about, is Schwab actually against the World Economic Forum? If the World Economic Forum is for the Fourth Industrial Revolution, or are both Schwab and the World Economic Forum against the Fourth Industrial Revolution? Well, that sounds crazy, Joaquin, because, you know, didn't they invent it? Aren't they the ones pushing it? Yeah, they're also the ones pushing it. But what's it? So there's obviously, there's different agendas afoot. There's different Fourth Industrial Revolutions. There's the one that they're talking about, and the one they're trying to pass a bunch of laws and create an increased privatized corporate digital sphere to replace the commons as part of a cancel culture. And cancel culture their way into a technocratic dictatorship. And you can't have that unless you have this monopoly privatization of the economy. But the development of the physical economy is actually going in a different direction. It's actually going, and not just in a hiccup, but as a longer term trend, ultimately, just think in terms of where you are now and think about what we can call zero points. A zero point beyond the intersection of, you know, or beyond the parabola. And at a zero point, all these equations reach their final expression. For example, with automation, the zero point is going to be that everything is automated. All of goods and service production is automated, because that is the overall direction of all technologies, right? And so at that zero point, economically, what you're really looking at is how do we make it, how do we have a culture? Are we really going to propose that whatever, you know, whatever we produce, that we have to be monitored by a global system? So what they're trying to do is interject the need for a regulatory mechanism to perfect the inefficiencies in the present, you know, process of production, distribution, meeting needs. This was used in Allende's Chile, in his economy, the tin industry and the different physical production points. And they used like an early internet so that as supplies were being used raw materials at one facility. It was sending in real time using, you know, basically like a kind of like a fax machine, but to the computer, like a modem. They used modems. They had a private BOD, obviously. And they had an intranet, even back then, right? Almost 50 years ago. So this is not new. That was almost 50 years ago. So yeah, you can, but the underlying assumption that they want to propose is that we've reached an upward limit of consumption potential. And there is a fair point about that. However, because they've connected consumption unquestioningly without introducing their own insistence on planned obsolescence. So once we untangle this planned obsolescence, see, once you understand that planned obsolescence is what they're not addressing, then it's very easy for them to pivot onto the carbon footprint. Because yes, at the end of the day, there is that. But if you're tracking, well, and this is what we're going to dig into today, what we'll find is that it's possible, or we need to open the conversation between experts in, do they make sense? Experts and people who make sense. And if you're an expert at making sense, I want to hear your take on where this is supposed to go. And I want to hear about the state of new technologies. This debate's not happening in the public sphere. They're just appointing the experts that gave us lockdowns, that gave us checkpoints. How convenient, of course. But we're not here to be rhetorical or to point out hypocrisies. We want to be, today we are not in a fight for life or death. Today we are in the pursuit of truth today. I mean, this morning. Maybe later today we'll be in a fight for life and death. So, hey, come at me. Come at me, bro. Come at me. Yep, that's what it boils down to. So, when we look at their narrative, right, they're not wrong when they connect their intention to unwind constitutional norms, to move against constitutional republican systems, and to build in a technocracy through a digitalized and real world, in terms of their goons and their hooligans in the streets, coup, a technocratic coup. Look at the inordinate influence they have. But this is, in turn, activities which are condoned and help coordinate by the intelligence services, which might give people the wrong idea that there is a sovereign state working through the intelligence services, which in turn controls the activities of these, you know, Zaibatsu monstrosities, the Japanese system of picking winners. Yeah, I'm informed it was also the system under the Park dictatorship of South Korea. And probably lots of Japanese there too involved, but probably gave more credibility to North Korea at that time during the Park dictatorship. But yeah. But one of the most challenging ideas that I've had to confront is the dynamism between the forces of political structures and the forces of technological change. The kind of political structures which propose the least potential harm to people, what they call society, right? Remember, it was Heidegger's idea that you have this error made in the transition or between pre-Socratic and Socratic philosophy, and he blames Socratic philosophy, but he misunderstands it. There's a lot of conflation in his time, of course, with Descartes and Plato. This had been a prevailing confusion even coming out of the Renaissance. But anyway, Heidegger says that at this time, you know, whatever, 2,500, 2,300 years ago, and there's a very interesting point here. We talk about society and we talk about people. And when we talk about that someone is antisocial or has harmed society, we mean that as a heuristic, as a shortcut for saying like they've harmed, you know, either the horizons or the reality of a great number of people, right? And isn't that what we're, I mean, buildings don't have feelings. We only really, I mean, the problem with damage to buildings is that it's damage to people, whether it's productive, people reliant, employed by it, or its owners, their investment. I mean, it's harm to people. Talk about nuclear weapons will destroy the world. No, motherfucker, nuclear weapons will destroy people. The world will still be here. They're not earth movers. They just, you know, radiation or whatever they are. I'm not a nuclearologist, but I do know that they lie a lot about their weapons, but I will say I don't want to be nuked. But it's not going to destroy the world. It's going to destroy our world, like, you know, our existence, our way of life. If you survive, good luck. You'd wish you were dead. At least how they tell the story. But assuming it's true, you don't want that. But it's not going to destroy planet Earth. And likewise, a lot of the things that they say, that, you know, with society, they're really, we should be talking about people. What if the society is anti-human? You see, then would you being, you could be antisocial and follow the anthropic principle. How does that work out? What? Well, so these are the contradictions that Heidegger says grow in time, that at a lower level of technology, the difference between people and society was so minimal. In other words, society was the recognition just that people as individuals also live together. We must. You imagine being a single guy in a very, very small town and like you have, you know, being from a big city, I think is great. I was trying to imagine what it must have been like for people. Once there's like a kind of story about you, then everyone kind of thinks they know you. And that's like their narrative about, or who's controlling that narrative about you. That's kind of weird. You're all limited in terms of people that you can, your dating options are like predetermined by like the mentality of the town or something. You can see why larger human settlements promoted different types of risk-taking. And risk-taking is going to figure into a good thing in our talk today. Okay. So in Heidegger's view, and we're not going to be talking about Heidegger much more than 30 seconds, but just to understand, among many other things that he said, His work was mostly incomplete, and he had some pretty, you know, from hindsight, and I know hindsight is 2020, but disastrous life decisions, you know, professionally. These were ideas in his time. I don't make excuses for anybody. I don't know what, you know, is going on with him. There's an ongoing debate upon, you know, about Heidegger and the degree to which there was some other things released recently about, you know, his kind of like his unpublished works and things like this. The black with a black box or something. Anyway. But you can see this point is very interesting, and you can own it, and it can be your idea without being married to anything else Heidegger said, because he might have arrived at that idea incorrectly. He might have arrived at it through an incorrect process, I mean. Doesn't matter. You see what I'm saying, how these things work out? So listen to a lot of different people anyway. I'm not proposing to be eclectic. You have to be actually, in fact, methodical. But this is a very interesting observation, because at the time, human people and society was almost the same thing. But as technology grows, as society grows, you can start to see that it takes on a life of its own. It kind of becomes an independent entity. It almost, and the power structures and the way that decisions are made about outcomes are increasingly divorced and alienated from the good outcomes for people. And this co-aligns, at the very least, you know, it's predictive with the rise of techno-industrial civilization. So when you're against society, are you against the machine? And can you be against the machine without being against the people? And in fact, then the question is posed, maybe, do you have to be against the machine to be in favor of the people? And then how do you view society? Well, I would suggest to be pro-social and to see the machine as a cancer or an AI, a self-replicating, meaning even, you know, cancerous, self-replicating, parasitic development that grows upon complexity, on systems of complexity. The ever more complex a system grows, the more that you're going to generate levels of consciousness and that it will act in its own interest. This is like in remember in Fantasia with Mickey Mouse, when he's like, it's actually an older story, but people might remember it. The Sorcerer's Apprentice. This is like Heidegger's idea with that, in a sense, but almost like a Frankenstein's monster. Marx would probably even agree and call that alienation, and actually describes that the process of the machine is really directing things. And then it's really a question of, does this machine that has its own consciousness, does it even have the ability to predict and to generate consciousness in humans? Is the machine, is the AI machine itself the satanic force? Is it the consciousness that's generated out of pure matter? Can you generate a consciousness with its own needs without spirit? It's very interesting. Very interesting questions, both philosophically, theologically, scientifically. But to reiterate, we were saying that the type of political systems or political structures which we can see produce the least potential harm to people of society in the period of, you know, from the 18th and 19th, and maybe the beginning of the 20th centuries, these were the societies that produced that really, or confirmed or helped co-produce and or were the realizations of these ideas about separation of powers and other methods to limit the growth of tyranny or of a permanent government power. And all of this was to prevent such a negative scenario, such as in monarchies or permanent dictatorships, right? Like where the government would have the complexity and power to act on its own, like independently from people. So the force of technological change is going to tend in the final analysis to bend the force of the political to its own need. Political are human beings that have minds, supposedly, but this technology in itself is like its own consciousness, and it's sort of false flagging all of us that this Leviathan or behemoth, if you will, is society. And we would propose that in such a, you know, simulacrum society that Zelensky and Ukraine will exist in perpetuity. We'll just upload their consciousness to the mainframe. So the force of technological change in the final analysis is going to bend the force of the political to its own need, okay? But there's a big however, because then things change. And there's introductions to new fields of applied sociology, which today make it possible to understand this process we've been talking about, and then even prevent or better yet shape other directions using conscious activity like political force to bend and determine which technologies are developed and which are not. All of this would suggest some sense of having or desiring or seeing why they would so desperately need, and the question of is then to which extent have they failed either locally or globally to institute the type of monopoly required to bite the bullet, right? Because the thing they need to do to remain in power is actually very unprofitable in the capitalist sense of profit. Even though these are the capitalists or a branch of them, they are using sociology to look at the rise of technology and this zero point that we discussed. And there's a few zero points and they're interconnected. The first zero point we talked about in our thought experiment at what happens, and we didn't finish it, so let's do it. At what point are new technologies and automation lead to a zero cost of goods and services? Well, first of all, there would be no such thing as financial services. First of all, that's an obvious one. The second is that it would be very difficult to charge a price for that thing, especially once the initial investment in the terms of the automation, this is over time. So we're already talking about the zero point. So this, we're already talking about the process by which things still have a price. There's still a return on investment to get. But all new technologies that are labor-saving are inherently disinflationary. Which means that your purchasing power per dollar goes up. You can have even less money by denomination numerically, but have a purchasing power geometrically greater than present existing purchasing power per dollar. So you have a cabal. And they are trying to use applied sociology to prevent this fourth industrial revolution, if by fourth industrial revolution we mean a legislative agenda at the federal level, which is a commitment to the in the direction of states' rights and local government to decentralize political decisions, to make the guarantees on encroachment of many new businesses that are going to be popping up both directly and in support upstream, downstream of 3D printing, which we're going to discuss how that relates to trade war, China, automation, outsourcing in just a bit. Now, so we understand, just to reiterate, that the force of technological change in the final analysis is going to bend the force of the political to its own need. And that has actually been, generally speaking, much of human history. But with the science of sociology, you change outcomes, but you also understand how there was unconscious sociologies at play before. Like, in other words, there were social practices in the past which lent significant character to the iteration of a given society of a given time. This point is lost today because of the interpretation and interrelation of a very flawed Marxist conception of stages of history being either uniform or necessarily progressive. But the predominant thinking in terms of, so in the fields of applied social anthropology and applied sociology, including its, you know, iterations both in corporate law and in public and private, or, you know, business and corporate administration or public administration. We talked previously about Theory X and Theory Y. Okay. How they're using the language of Theory Y to keep with Theory X. So they have the social engineering. They're saying this is necessary for the fourth industrial revolution to happen, but they're trying to attempt a very big cultural shift, right? And a legislative agenda, for example, in the U.S. Congress, there'd been legislation recently proposed, I don't think it made it, but it'll come back, to limit, Democrats proposed, it's pretending to be anti-corporate legislation about 3D printing, that there's going to be a legislative group that approves which companies can do 3D printing, so that they can pick the monopoly, and not, they're claiming that it's to prevent some monopoly from forming, but in fact, by them being the regulatory system of who can get in the business, they're going to create a monopoly. That has to be shut down, because part of the solutions in claiming the future, see, I can claim the future as an individual, and I can just try to think ahead in terms of my grandchildren. It's very hard to start to predict about your great-grandchildren. What things are you, you know, does your fucking samurai code transmit down. No, it doesn't. You love them no matter what, right? So, but people think, I mean, think about graveyards. They don't really have very old graveyards. We worry about that. And then, you know, there's not really graveyards for great-great-grandparents, is there? Why not? Yeah, because you know what happens. So living in reality, there's got to be a localization of the scientific affairs model, and we need to, and states and regions and countries can host world fairs like the Hanover Fair, you know, but that 4IR, even though people had a lot of horizontalist thinking or, you know, understand the liberatory aspects of the outcomes of, you know, let's say more refined or precise production processes, this is more limited to using real-time, you know, feedback towards almost like what Jeremy Rifkin would call zero marginal cost. Anyway, such pipe dreams. But in other words, this is catastrophic and inherently misanthropic what this breakaway society junta is trying to do, because they've made the human being the problem versus society. Whereas in fact, the human being, especially when you start talking about some significant plurality or even the majority or probably the 99.9999% of us and many elites within that, you know, 0.9999% appreciate the difference between being, you know, a 700 millionaire and a 100 billionaire. And they're presently involved in what might look like conservative causes that the youth and the left don't understand, but which are actually part of populist movements that are going to actually help that youth have jobs in the process of, import substitution industrialization. And, you know, even, and all things point to good ultimately, especially when you look at weakened currencies in first world countries, like that's going to be entirely connected with this. The point is that the elite, because they have really made many mistakes and failed, are trying to make a political junta control ballot outcomes and with the electronic voting and also connect you everything to a meter, right? When planned obsolescence at the production level, not at the distribution, not at your waste, not your taking too long a showers or that you flush twice. You see the difference? This is a very big difference. So, yeah, so you have this attempt to use social engineering to justify their whatever crazy version of this fourth industrial revolution. But clearly, if you're talking about the types of changes that the actual emergent technologies are pushing, this works against. You see, even a lot of bigger private banks could invest and still are, but need to in medium and large, but not, you know, giant gargantuan monopolies. But a lot of these, of course, are spin-offs or fronts of other empires. But there are real inventors out there who, because of IP, are in the position to genuinely lead startups and startups that start as, you know, medium-sized enterprises, you know, multi, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars going through a year. So there's no reason not for this. And it is happening. It just, we focus so much on kind of like doom scrolling and we focus a lot on reacting to world events. And we kind of take for granted that there's other people, including us, but in our other hours of the day are actually doing things. Not just like trying to absorb information about what's wrong, but actually finding the opportunities that arise. And that's what we're talking about. If you're an entrepreneur or an investor, this is also very good approach in thinking, right? And also this framework is highly valuable in explaining this, what's going on to other potential investors that might buy into your project. So in terms of how, you know, we in the field of political science have over a few thousand years understood this process is that there's a relationship, very direct relationship, between the structures of your political system and the structures of your economic system, okay? And even though we tend to think in terms of there's some desired outcome by a political party to create a centralized political system, we think about, oh, you know, the socialists or the fascists want to create a centralized political system, what you actually find is that the technologies that were inherent to the 20th century level of technology produced certain various potential political outcomes that varied in some way significantly from one another, but they all had very similar tendencies on the other hand. Certainly there was some you'd want to live in other than others, but they all had to deal with certain hard problems. So when you define the, you know, political regimes of modernity, these, you know, increasingly highly kind of centralized police state-ish, you know, Western democracies, or then you look at the fascist states, or you look at the so-called communist or the socialist bloc, or those states, non-aligned, some of them, you find that, you know, we think in terms of looking at their differences between one another, but we're highly limited if we also aren't looking at their similarities. So the Davos conspiracy of Schwab and Gates, etc., they're working to prevent the type of fourth industrial revolution which the real existing technologies, not the suppressed and hidden technologies, the real existing technologies already lay the foundation for. Nuclear power, 3D printing, the internet for plans to 3D print, not the internet for regulating or a punitive, horizontal punitive system, Jeremy Bentham's, you know, panopticon, everyone policing each other, fucking Scanner Darkly system. Anything but allowing power to decentralize. Anything. Anything. In terms of where this cabal is at. And you can hear the power vacuum. The suction is that, you know, fucking strong. It's an audible thing, this vacuum of power. So, yeah, by 2020, by the year 2020, the dominant ruling party in the West, inherited from structures built during the Cold War in the 20th century, had created a culturally insulated simulacrum. Like, people talk about a breakaway civilization. Well, this was a breakaway culture. It was the outcome of that which led this ruling junta to believe that a breakaway civilization is possible, let alone desirable, but they actually think it's possible. So as a consequence of the real-world failures of this dominant ruling party, which had largely built their authoritative agenda on the basis of a further geopolitical routing of post-communist Russia, they failed to disassemble Russia into whatever 10, fucking 14, 18 different constituent countries. Right, it's the outcome of all of this that has shaped this reality. And they had attempted from the end of the Cold War to avoid Hannibal's curse, achieving the victory but failing to build victories upon it, right? So the reality of the degraded American U.S. military force, even by 1990, had already been at odds with the arms industry and entertainment industry simulacrum, fucking G.I. Joe, Invincible, everything, you know, Top Gun. And they produced this white paper, this project for New American Century, produced this white paper describing that, and this was when you had Donald Rumsfeld say, we go to war with the army that we have, not the army that we wish we had. And what that really means is that we're going to go to war with the opponent that we think we can beat, not the opponent that we have to beat. So they started to like target these little other countries. I mean, Haiti, Rwanda, they're not taking on the big boys. What, Saddam Hussein, Iraq, like, you know, come on. That was a solo mission. Yugoslavia was a combined Europe-NATO mission using a trilateral model of colonial redistribution of the plunder, whereas, you know, Iraq, the reason that you had why people maybe in the early internet and early 2000s thought that fucking Europeans were so progressive or so on point was just because their own ruling class had been cut out because the neocon move cut out Europe into with the Iraq stuff. Actually, remember, Saddam was trying to actually, you know, segue laterally from sanctions and switch to euros. Remember that? Nothing, you know, good about, nothing good about, I mean, that's good for him if he tried to try to, well, we saw what happened, but I'm not against him trying to do that. But remember all of that? So that, you know, they knew that they didn't have a military that can do these things. That's not their theory of power. It's just not their theory of power. It is a very sophisticated theory of power, but with that sophistication is an inherent complexity which exceeds beyond the necessary elegance level of balanced complexity towards function that you would desire to have. So it's now inelegant and yet further complex. In a sense, the machine itself has become neurotic. And it confronted with the crisis, the consciousness of this, we said like a behemoth or like a leviathan, has taken on a consciousness of its own towards its own ends, almost independent of what's good for human beings. And we can call this demonic or even Satan itself, in a sense, in a literary sense, because it also has such a power to possess the minds of the people involved in it who actually believe themselves to be acting in some interest, even their own. And it's not. Not practically, not really, not in terms of their dopamine addiction habits, chasing that dragon, and at the spiritual level, very corrosive. Very unhappy people. Nancy Pelosi. Look at her. What a disaster of a life it has been. Coming from one of the ruling families of California. So they actually failed to get this one world order, and the type of monopolies they would need and they saw that they, I mean, they knew it. When I had first encountered this analysis that in fact that the US had also lost the Cold War, like that the Cold War produced no winners, when you look at the power of media just to say these things, think about how they generated that phenomenon of the end of the Cold War. But when you look at a victory, but in order to appear like a victory by kind of how the Western discourse had defined what its outcomes would be, like they changed the flag, the Soviet state collapsed, and it, you know, there was new countries that had broken out of it. So that looks like the victory. But the cost of doing that to your budget, the creation of the military industrial complex, the liberality with which intelligence services were granted to, you know, kidnap, torture people, to, you know, secret police, and all of these encroachments on basic life, were part of the cost of this, and the things that they created, and the type of fictional economy that they created in terms of the, it was necessary, in a sense, to create this over-financialization of every sector of the economy, to make it look like all of these liabilities were also assets, and then use that asset claim as some very flimsy, but, you know, backed by gunboats, to claim the value of a currency, which they could then produce. They had the monopoly on producing, as if you could just convince everybody that this is basically gold. That you produce at a predictable rate, that you can actually control the faucet, not like a gold mine. I mean, the upward limits. They actually underproduce gold all the time, but that's not the question. There are upward limits. Whereas what you saw with the quantitative easing regime there, and then with the bailouts from 2000 COVID, the event 201 bailouts. So, but you already had a degraded American force, and that was the foundation of the Rumsfeld thinking. And so, you know, the policy of the Bush administration at this time, then under this neocon spell, was to attack and use sanctions on countries which, you know, really were kind of in a weaker position, but had not been uncooperative with the Yugoslavia and Iraq were like non-aligned countries. And even though Iraq with Saddam definitely, and, you know, CENTCOM and the, you know, the coup within the Ba'athist revolution or whatever, that saw Saddam into power, you know, so he was even closer to American interests than Yugoslavia. And they attacked him. So that's not, you know, that's like a very, they didn't have the power. It's not like the Soviet Union collapsed and then they were able to, like, you know, force, militarily force a further breakup of Russia. That would have been really the fantasy. And so what they do instead is Iraq, Yugoslavia, and then that's really the most. I mean, that's everything else is kind of like not even a power in terms of like Haiti or, come on, Rwanda or the Horn, Eritrea, Ethiopia, what, Somalia. So, and we saw at that time, right, a hard degradation of rights under the Patriot Act, anti-terrorism legislation, new security processes. All of this is their attempts to preempt things. Just think about this, okay? Just understand what's happening as well. In the 20th century, the technologies and your daily life, like where you worked and how you had to work, were so connected to physical location, and then the supply lines and the upstream and downstream economies were so integrated, not just at the national level, but in fact in this globalized economy with its complex supply lines, right? That the structure of that society had a very conforming outcome. They had a very determinative, like what they found, what they have found, for example, like, and they even use this in, unfortunately now, even like in prosecuting criminal cases against people, is from their phone, their daily patterns on like where they walk and where they drive is the same and predictable as if they were robots. Us people. So they already have all like a lot of information about our whereabouts and things like this, but the information about our whereabouts is not the same thing as making us go certain places or not making us go certain places. So tracking, right, and creating the path is not the same thing, even though you might need to first track in order to later create what people do, right? Because we talked about how they are talking about monetizing human activity with sensors and your body heat, measuring activity, and having you do receiving messages like on your phone, like day labor, you know, like those labor ready places, and just have it by phone appear here today. You're not actually paid, but if you don't appear there for work, then they cut you off from your UBI. So it's kind of like some slave labor, actually. Did slaves have money? Yeah, so slaves had money. Slaves were even paid for things you can look at how slavery was done in the South, and we're talking about chattel slavery in the American South, but also in ancient Greece and stuff. You could hand currency to slaves, and it might be a more efficient, you might even arrive at better efficiency in the decisions they make for running the plantation in terms of them making their own provisions. In other words, you might end up paying them, you'd probably get away with paying them less in money than you would have to provide in kind, and be like seen as responsible for the outcomes of all the things that you've provided in kind. So these are interesting concepts to think about in terms of freedom and what is slavery and how does that work? Okay. So when you think about this process, centralization of political, okay, in the past, because work required these centralizing predictive practices, they didn't need to transform the system of your work, their daily pattern, into something that's mandatory by them saying it, because it was mandatory by your need to pay a mortgage or pay rent. You see the difference? So evidence that they know that that system is going in the direction against them having a coercive power against you, that the actual technologies and the actual economy that would emerge otherwise is not conducive to centralization of power. They're trying to preempt and create a system of regimentation and controls now, and to create the narrative and to control what's allowed to be said and to control the clarity, lack thereof, or creativity of our future potentials and our outcomes, and eliminate all this talk about decentralization, freedom, liberty. Now, what we want to understand is how constitutional republican systems exist in societies based in new applied technologies. And then we understand it's much simpler in terms of if we've understood everything we've talked about so far. So just remember, so you had this whole time, remember how they have done with your credit score, Equifax, right? You probably have a 700 credit score if you own a home mostly and haven't really been late on payments. But if you don't own a home and you've not always been on time with payments, and you know, maybe you've even had to default on a car loan or something, then you probably have around a 540, 550 credit score. And if you're going to qualify for, you know, certain loans, so they have you already on a matrix of behavior. See, I've been trying to explain that in peripheral Europe and post-communist countries, you see a lower income on paper, but people don't live on credit. And so a lot of things are not priced based upon thinking that you can charge it and pay later, because prices are not competitive. They're actually just the roof on prices is just the, you know, ceiling of your tolerance, not someone having a better price or something. No. So I mean, they're not going to move unless you move. So they need to capture markets and capture audiences and remove the competitive aspect. They want risks and competition. In other words, danger and play, which are some of the foundational aspects of male motivations. And while one could debate the reasons for male leadership in inventions, one cannot deny the reality of that. So to deny people from exploration and from danger is to deny a very big aspect of the human experience, which has been part of our survival and our meaning. Now, conclusively, then, we saw that the empire was moving in tandem, pushing on weaker countries because it didn't really have a military power to push on its real rivals. Probably lost credibility in the process. And that was moving in tandem with your degradation of rights at home. Everything under gun control, speech, the TSA, lists, warrantless searches, these asset seizures, police in all these states, never consent to a search, period. Am I free to go? Can I be on my way? Have you done everything you need to do for this stop under the pretext that I was stopped for? Or are you on a fishing expedition at the cost of my liberty and my time? Now, so in understanding what's happened in the U.S., yeah, have there been stupid ideas that appear to be leading the way towards our degradation of rights? Yeah, but really, it's been centralized industry producing centralized politics. The power is unified and uses politics and politics by other means against other interests in society, even the vast majority interest. Yet new technologies are producing decentralized solutions across a number of fronts. Decentralized, right, like localized at the point of production, at the point of distribution, and not requiring other similar points beyond the scope of its decentralized character. So we're not saying totally cut off, but the scale of complexity of interreliance moves horizontally and net-centric and not top-down oligarchical or, let's say, inherited hierarchical places, as opposed to direct manifest competencies like a meritocracy. So despite that, meritocracy has been code and language also for technocracy in the past. We're bereft of a language. The socialists want freedom. They call it socialism. Conservatives want freedom. They call it freedom. But nevertheless, here we are. There's some overlap in those freedoms. and actually the vision and what the future is. And the system is going to rely upon us having a confused political language. Okay. Now, they're not God, but they're playing God. Okay. So they're trying to confuse our language. Them in their sort of demiurgic overlord emanation. But it's new technologies that are producing decentralized solutions, and that's across a number of fronts. Now, planned obsolescence is the real culprit. But without planned obsolescence, you would have had a much lower rate of unemployment, but many fewer hours necessary for people to work every day, a much lower velocity of money, a much lower GDP growth, if by which we also unfortunately define GDP growth not adjusted for inflation and also not adjusted even more insanely, or as insanely, not adjusted, because over time, right, not adjusted for debt. But you can live very well on $500 a month if each dollar buys a lot more. That's what we talk about, disinflationary outcomes of labor-saving technologies. The problem is that the rate of the actual velocity or the repetition rate of making profit per item disappears when you eliminate planned obsolescence. So we're not talking about the profit motive of a creator, of an innovator, but we're talking about a product where obviously now for some time, all of the investment into R&D is there. You're not talking about a particular, IP, intellectual product, property. You're talking about actually many firms doing the same thing, not new technologies, not new innovations, and working. They don't need a conspiracy because it's the best business practice at the level of monopoly and of economies of scale to have planned obsolescence. And this co-aligns with centralized economy. It works with this idea that idle hands do the devil's work. So you've got people occupied and their patterns and their lives are predictable and they're controlled. Whether they think they're free on any given day, only if you change jobs is your bird's eye view route going to change every day, right? But in the future, people's lives become as predictable, but much less controllable. And so the need on the legislative front of the cabal of this techno-industrial behemoth, this AI consciousness that possesses these minds like Pelosi and Schwab and Trudeau, is probably the devil himself. But because planned obsolescence is the real culprit in terms of this process involved, in any question of sustainability, tying a carbon footprint to this as if it's done by the, like in the way that they do it today, tries to make the question one of the number of human beings or the rate of consumption of goods instead of the quality of goods consumed, which relates to their lifespan and hence the real rate of necessary consumption of goods. Not the restriction, not fucking caloric restriction, for the love of Christ. I mean, you know, not when it's like that. Not if the calories you're getting are going to be maggots. This is the problem they're dealing with. They're like, we want to have caloric restriction, but we want to shorten our lifespans. See, there's lots of things they move in different directions. Well, if they have to take the booster every year, that will shorten their lifespan probably. Oh, that's true. So caloric, don't worry about caloric restriction. In fact, all the things that they are going to propose with UBI, and they're going to act like suddenly they're going to have this fake revolution in healthcare where if you've got the jab, then you have access to all this monies and services. And they're thinking this is from the system, this is a long-term investment because it's kind of like they know you're going to die soon. See, in terms of the dead peasants formula or in terms of the profit per person, like, you have a value, how much real dollars you're going to produce in your lifespan for the system. Right? Even your savings, when you buy products or services with those, even as investments, they are part of that too, to the system. So they take all of that, right? And the more that you have automation, and the more that you have automation plus 3D printing, the less human beings are involved in that process of production, has a disinflationary effect on price. And the zero point of that price is zero. Zero number of jobs and zero price on items. And thinking like a tyrant and thinking like you have to be the all-seeing eye or Sauron or whatever you have to be, they want to use data inputs and transform them into control mechanisms. It's still in a primitive state, a lot of their technology, in terms of even the social control stuff. Now, you can say maybe, well, this is them getting real-world practice and getting ahead of the curve, but they've also let on their plans to such extent that they've sparked the counter-hegemonic movement in greater proportion to their effort. So anyway, you can see that even in a real transition economy, even if a sudden supply chain disruption was desirable towards like an import substitution, industrialization, reindustrialization, etc., the interaction between 3D printing and the repairs industry will be realized at the time. So the repairs industry, like what you want is, for example, at the state level, if you have state taxes or business licenses, where are your electeds talking about eliminating taxes or certain regulations on people who are doing repairs? Right? Oftentimes you don't throw out the whole computer. Oftentimes there's just a bubble pop resistor or something like that, like on the back of a big screen TV. And people are like, oh, the TV's out. How much are you doing? Oh, they have them on sale at a Walmart, $700. Okay, pick up a new one, charge it. Okay, that's bland obsolescence. But a lot of these parts are the same ones that break, and people know it, and you can have local. You can eliminate the many costs relating now to the liabilities of a business of scale. You have it localized. So you've eliminated transportation costs. You can work in tandem at the way that a private or a singular operator entrepreneur could work in relationship to calls and making your own schedule. The repair industry is the industry of today. And when I say tomorrow, I don't mean like the world tomorrow, but like for the foreseeable fucking future. And then how 3D printing is going to be used by the repair industry, stopgap, for example, a total shutdown of supply chains, or look, China has a growing middle class, and they're going to need to meet the needs of that growing middle class and also transform away from a very similar system they have of planned obsolescence. But even under planned obsolescence, and in fact, in many ways connected to it, they actually have to orient towards employment and go through the Fordist period where the employees can afford to buy the things that they're making. And then that's why they've built all these cities in advance, like pre-constructed cities for millions. They know that they're going to have population movement and increased like base living conditions. China is moving like that. I'm just saying, in combination with many other things that they're doing, whether you like or not, right or wrong, that's one thing that is happening, is that they're preparing. The point being here that they're preparing to move more towards regional distribution and understand maybe whether they're talking about war, global insecurity, or just basic supply line issues, or the needs of just-in-time production. We talk about JIT, just-in-time, being kind of at odds with Chinese model. Chinese is just-in-time compared to people who promise just-in-time, but there's a lot of capital investment required to get them ready to be that part of your, filling in the gaps insurance on production issues globally in your global supply chain setup. You have globalized production. So in a real transition economy away from that, you would have import substitution industrialization, you would have reindustrialization. There's lots of work that has to be done for that, lots of investment, lots of labor, and then all of the things that people with those jobs then spend their money on. Think about it. And those are real dollars because they're productive. They're going into the physical economy. Right. So between that, 3D printing and the repairs industry. Now, so globalized supply chains and the development of 3D printing work inversely. As the cost increase of global supply chains, investment into innovation and 3D printing is one of the many outcomes. They're directly correlated inversely. And not directly, inversely. But they're intimately correlated inversely. And so the ruling party today pushes towards greater coercive technologies, and they try to change the culture about what you accept and what the accepted regular procedures are. Security checks for work, for travel, controls on expenditures, and even like trying to make new categories of money through digital tracking. Things that you can't buy or things that you should spend on. But you see, they've been doing things like coupons and things like this for a long time to kind of control things like this. But that's another subject. I know it's weird to think about in terms of like controlling production and redistribution process based upon. I mean, every kid knows that, like, right? Like when things are on sale at the stores, because they have more inventory they need to get on the shelves, and so they have to clear so they don't get a backlog in their supply chain. And so they can also clear the number of items. You know, they also build an automatic, business model into the expectations of store managers, of course, but even without those, you would have these issues. So you can see that, that Schwab and the World Economic Forum, they're actually working against what you would call a fourth industrial revolution. And they're attempting to redirect its evolution. Social patterns, interactions that you have, and rather they're trying to stop the process already underway of dynamic, horizontal, peer-to-peer developments, both politically, which is why, you know, thanks to Abrams, we have even less reliable voting. Amazing. But just think about it the same way. These are can very much connected. Okay. The controls that they're trying to make on voting outcome is because prior to the internet, they simply could declare who are the viable candidates through the media. And you didn't have peer-to-peer networks where passionate people, activists, whether Democrats or Republicans, could actually operate as activists in the party and talk to each other, not through newsletters or through the RNC or the DNC. So that pushed the direction of both of those, you know, bases in much more populist directions. Not the fake Democrat, whatever, woke-tivism, but I'm talking about Democrats from before woke, you know, just, which is most Democrat voters, by the way. It's a very strange thing how they deal with it. We can do a strategy session maybe sometime to talk about that in relation to November. But yeah, they're going to have a lot of GOTV issues around what issue? Campaigning against Russia? Please. So you have this move by this junta to make this kind of new technocracy and move against the real developments in what's increasingly becoming an informal economy, okay? And the informal economy, understanding the foundation of the formal informal economy is the same thing as understanding the foundation of money, okay? Economies don't exist because they are formalized, and money doesn't exist because governments emit currency. These are money, like property, are real existing tangible outgrowths of your fingers, your arms, your legs. Okay? That's what it means to be your property. And the informal economy is the real economy, bald, naked. It proves, really, where economies come from. Just as it proves where money comes from. Just because states sanction money doesn't mean that we don't have money without states. They can create a digital currency and convince fucking imbeciles that that's the end of it. Real people are going to be trading things. And then there's going to be kind of some kind of, you know, more maybe even local, but medium of exchange to get that done in a uniform way. So you know before, so you don't have to have in mind the barter value of your item on 15 different potential trades on a day. You can have one price mechanism. So the informal economy is the real economy. And the more that as the ruling party further encroaches into direct controls over certain purchases, okay, this only expedites the consequence of the growth of the so-called informal gray market, black market economy. The risks versus rewards of engaging in those will tend to ultimately produce the very same balance required towards their continuation and growth. That's what taking a risk means. The greater number of people turned away from the risk based upon the severity of the risk predetermines your share of the returns because you're the one who did it. It's could be nearly monopolistic even. So there's tremendous incentive, the greater the risk. Now, you can see in conclusion that since the informal economy is the real economy, and since it's people who create money out of the need that actually derives in the process evolution of barter, we just haven't thought about needing to talk to neighbors and stuff like that for a long time. If the information revolution and, you know, cheap energy, now albeit hidden by profit margins, but in reality it's been cheap energy, okay, that's a big lie that energy is expensive. If the information revolution and cheap energy relative to the past, by the way, that when we talk about energy being expensive, that those are often forward projections, of course. But we talk about, and that's almost a critical deconstruction of the present. It's almost kind of bizarre. When you want to evaluate your progress, you also need to include, are you doing it better than you used to do it? And cheap energy is cheap compared to the past. And that's what characterizes the third industrial revolution. And it also saw actually the rise of a net-centric decentralized internet, which produced the effect of a social mass nevertheless. And we can see in 3D printing and the Internet of Things the process of disconnection from the global supply chain system, including the contest between China versus just-in-time production. You know, talking about even in the system of how it looked in its 2019 form, today is different already. That had to happen no matter what. Now we can see here why Rifkin and others want to redefine these terms and pretend that the energy revolution, or rather revolutions, didn't come yet. They want to ignore that you didn't have that, you know, about nuclear and et cetera, or how OPEC operates, et cetera. The petrodollar. So we've got our terms confused, and they're the ones that have created, as we discussed before, the contradiction in the terms third and fourth industrial revolutions by their own metric, by their own thinking. So in terms of constitutional republican systems, in conclusion, we can't think of the economic independently from the political, and we cannot think of the economic in terms of growth of GDP, but rather disinflationary currency outcomes as a consequence of new technologies which create new economies. The political and the economic are so intertwined, and there has been an age-old debate on, you know, which determines which. And whatever great effect human intention and culture and all of these other superstructural permutations had on, let's say, applied technologies, and, you know, the stronger case to be made is that really the nature of these technologies were driving the structure of the societies. But because we can understand that, and in the way we understand that, is called the field of sociology. So then when you look at what would be required to have the culture or the political intention actually define the economic, technologically speaking, outcome, requires sociology, but it also requires a cabal based upon that vision as a vanguard, as a junta, as an avant-garde, to try to implement. That runs counter to the direction of things to come if not stopped by this junta. That's what they are at war against. So likewise, we can say, just as they controlled the outcomes of voting through controlling information in the past, now they can't control the information in the past. Now they're trying to control the direct elections counting. Now that they can't control what you think or who you want to vote for, now they have to control the actual ballot system. And likewise, now that your work and your life can't be controlled through the structure of their economy, because decentralization is the direction of these technologies, they want to do a thing like with the elections and use direct regulation, direct coercion, like go against this and be fined and don't pay the fine, you go to jail. People with guns come and take you from your house violently. For taking too long of a shower. And so by understanding then, the actual world of abundance, in contrast to this fake contrived scarcity based on a fake contrived emergency, which conveniently gives them all of these emergency powers, they didn't need to do this in the past because the structures of society controlled for it. They didn't need control the counting of the ballot box. They could have clean, relatively speaking, clean elections in the U.S. at least, under, you know, all of these pretty agreeable monitoring systems. And those went out the window the minute they couldn't control it. That's not a sign of them getting stronger. That's a response to losing control. And that's the same thing that you're seeing today with the Great Reset and their version of the Fourth Industrial Revolution. The direction of things has gone in the direction of a great awakening and of greater human emancipation. There are applied technologies that can be a part of this, but without a very real and direct ethics and moral system based in humility and in service of an understanding that we live in a created world. This is all part of the paradigm to come. I would hope that the most advanced, I would say, agnostic and scientifically minded people among our audience would understand that in any given paradigm, historically speaking, the truths of the day were true based upon self perpetuating logic or circular logic. It's true based upon the premises that they've established that what I think our more astute scientifically minded audience members would appreciate is that scientific truth is a social construct. It's a social construct of the dominant paradigm. And it represents a certain value set. And we're not talking about empirical evidence or experimentation, which, by the way, they're losing at. They're actually losing that ability because of the corporate influence on science in that direction. Fake experiments, fake studies can't be repeated. It's a huge crisis. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about the fundamental naturalist fallacy. That's the fundamental rule. Despite our observation to the contrary that in our experience as human beings that create things, all the things that have all the features of being created normally have people that behind them that create them. So now if in looking at the next paradigm, you know, when you think about the things that you don't need, They want you to think in terms of owning nothing and being happy, and that doesn't make any sense, because you own yourself. And the greatest amount of satisfaction and meaning that people find in life is owning themselves, which means that they're able to make the agreements that about themselves and their place in the world that come from themselves, that they define their identity. These are fundamental human rights. So, and then they're not fundamental because we're upset if we don't have them, but because human beings stop functioning, they shut down, the suicide rates pop up. I mean, you might have human beings in the sense of they're consuming calories and they have a lifespan, but you really cease to have humanity in the way we know humanity. So the crisis of this elite and their mixed ideas, we exposed how they couldn't differentiate between third and fourth industrial revolution in terms of energy expenditure or new energy sources. We exposed how they can't invent what they can't define what money is, that people do it. We exposed how they're trying to confuse us. And even for a lot of the U.S. history, it was enough of, okay? But a lot of Republicans, in talking about the GOP establishment, were really the RNC. You have this tendency to conflate corporate rights and corporate and you know, huge business imperatives with the rights of the entrepreneur and the rights of small businesses to thrive in regulatory environments conducive to growth, right? And they scammed conservatives into supporting the growth of this techno-industrial leviathan and the encroachment on the commons in the digital sphere and the financialization of every sphere of life and the erosion of property rights ultimately. So very interesting. And likewise with the left, the scam was very similar. They pretended that the influence of organized labor on the Democrats was so great that they made these legislations against these large corporations, But then when you look at the fine print of this legislation, a lot of these same rules against the major corporations also applied to small businesses, which is not fair to begin with. But then the regulatory enforcement agencies only went after the small businesses. So that wasn't a victory for labor, because working people also have to buy things and live in the world. And monopoly conditions are not conducive to the best outcomes, are they, as a consumer? So to hell if you're making more money in nominal currency and wages because of a union contract, if the same party you're supporting to do that is behind a regulatory scheme that eliminates competition. That's how they divide and conquer. So while conservatives were scammed into protecting corporations by thinking they were protecting small businesses, Democrat voters were scammed into destroying small businesses by thinking they were putting regulations on big business. See how that works? We actually have a lot in common, all us people. We just have to understand and expose how we've been scammed, right? Because the way forward becomes a lot cleaner. Anyway, thanks for joining me today. That'll be our show. It'll be up on the drive very momentarily. And yeah, thanks for being with us. All right, cheers. I'm out.